It's a concept.
So, welcome. This is the panel, Confessions of a Gospel Doctrine Teacher, and we have quite a number of Gospel Doctrine teachers, or people who have done that at some point in their histories, here with us today. My name is Les Kripke, and I'll be the chair for this session. What we'll do is I'll introduce, do brief introductions, and then we will, each person will speak for approximately 10 minutes, and the rest of the session will be questions and answers and discussion. So, and I'll just say, now with Bob, I haven't gone over Bob's thing. I know Bob the best of anyone up here, and his resume is quite vast. And he's the only one here that I've actually been in his gospel doctrine class and had, you know, really some great times and good learning experiences. But Bob lives and works in the Santa Cruz Mountains. He writes frequently on subjects relating to Mormon culture and religion. Most recently, the Reader's Book of Mormon, which is a wonderful set of books from Signature, right outside the door here. He's Director of Education and Humanities at Institute of HeartMath, and has taught humanities for over 40 years at various universities, including UCLA, where I first met Bob, and UC Santa Cruz. He's active in Mormon Studies, currently serves on the advisory committee on Mormon Studies at Claremont Graduate University. And he's had a number of church callings, including bishop, seminary, and institute teacher, and counselor in the Baltic States Mission, where he and his wife Ruth served for 3.5 years. Next is Chris Corbett.
In alphabetical order. Bob, Chris.
Chris is an attorney, lives in Palo Alto. She says that the average age of her current Sunday school class members is probably 24 months. But she has taught older folks in the past, and she's a mother of two girls. Sheldon Greaves. He was a gospel doctrine teacher in Palo Alto First Ward, where he became known for following the text, but not the lesson manual. Graduated from Berkeley in 96 with an emphasis in Hebrew Bible, Canaanite religion, and religion and magic in ancient Mesopotamia. He's run a small science education software company and was the editor of the Citizen Scientists, an electronic newsletter. Frank Maxwell taught gospel doctrine in his ward in Gilroy, California for 6 years. He is currently teaching the Joseph Smith lessons in his priesthood quorum and is involved in getting Caltrain commuter rail service extended to Gilroy, appointed to Santa Clara County Transportation Commission for 2 years. Kim McCall. He's choir director, singer, contra dancer, European explorer, political activist, religious semi-scholar, Headstone board member, avid bike rider, uncle, pro bono programmer, senior research scientist, and currently a consultant for Plantronics from Stanford University. So thank you all. And we'll start 10 minutes each. I'll give you a little signal when we get close to that if needed. And we will start with Bob Reese.
Well, I guess I will stand up, since that's normally what gospel doctrine teachers do. I've been, Mary Ellen asked if she can steal the title of an essay I'm writing called Confessions of a Gospel Doctrine Teacher for this session, and I was happy to have her do so. I first started teaching gospel doctrine class 50 years ago in the old Joseph Smith Academy, at Brigham Young University when I first came home from my mission. I look at the difference between that time and this time, and it's really significant. What we taught then was Christ's ideals for living, a wonderful lesson manual written by O.C. Tanner, who happened to have been a good friend of David O. McKay's. And it was quite wonderful just to focus on the teachings of the New Testament, the teachings of Jesus. And there was no one standing in the back to make sure that you covered the lesson. It was really quite a lovely experience. As I've taught in different wards and different times, I sandwiched that experience with a recent experience, a conversation I had with a priesthood leader who will go unnamed, who in the probably 300 or 400 lessons that I taught in the San Lorenzo Valley ward where I live in the Santa Cruz State, in an interview said that the bishop had complained that on several occasions when he visited my class, I didn't always stick to the standard works, and that I didn't always close my lessons with my testimony. And my response back to him was, well, in the 2 or 3 times that the bishop came to my class over the 5 years that he was bishop, it might have been possible that I didn't bear my testimony. It might have been possible that I might have included other things besides the standard works. But if you want to ask anybody who was in my class in those years who attended regularly, I don't think anyone could accuse me of not teaching doctrine or not bearing or having a testimony. But there was a clear sense that there is now a kind of Procrustean bed for gospel doctrine teachers, and that one needs to conform. And before correlation, I think there was a much more open spirit about gospel doctrine classes and a much more vigorous and enlightened learning of the gospel in those classes. We tend now to have classes that are pretty much proof texting, and in which very little latitude, depending on the church the leaders, depending on the flexibility and openness of the bishop, allows. An experience I had in San Lorenzo Valley Ward a few years ago was that a member of the bishopric came to me and said, I noticed that you've been using the NIV in your teaching the New Testament, and you are now forbidden from using the NIV. And I generally use, when I teach the New Testament, especially when I teach Paul, I use 3 or 4 different translations, because I don't think even Jesus understood what Paul was trying to say. some of his epistles. And so I said to this brother, why are you putting this restriction on me? He said, because it's only with the King James that people can really feel the Spirit. And I thought that was an archaic, rather Byzantine idea. So I wrote him a letter, and in the letter I included a number of instances in which general authorities quoted from the NIV in their conference speeches and in the Ensign. He quoted from a number of other instances in which BYU studies and farms and elsewhere people use the NIV. He still insisted that I not use the NIV. And I said, you know, I can do that if you insist on it, but it seems really kind of, I didn't use the words I might have used, like wacky to me. But it said to me something about what has happened with the gospel doctrine class. Except, I think, in some rare wards where bishops really do allow teachers to teach and to rely on the Spirit, there tends to be a very narrow definition of what constitutes gospel doctrine. I have a good friend who served for many years on the Church Gospel Doctrine Lesson Committee, and he once said he and Hugh Nibley were teaching gospel doctrine class. And when they went to one of the meetings, he said, I asked Elder Maxwell, who convened the meeting of the Direction of the Twelve, how he felt about the fact that Hugh and I, as gospel doctors, teachers, didn't, quote, follow the manual to which it gave explicit approval, noting that if we didn't, where would the research come upon which future better manuals would be based? Well, there have been no future better manuals for a considerable amount of time. The other thing that Gordon, my friend Gordon Thomason, tells, and I'll close with this story, but I hope that we'll have an opportunity to talk about some of the other experiences that I've had as a gospel doctrine teacher. He said, once the scriptural selection about which I was assigned to write a lesson included, among other things, Acts 20:7-12, in which the Apostle Paul drones on for so long in the course of a sermon that a young man, ironically named Eustuchus, which means fortunate, dozes off and falls from the rafters. Paul has to restore him to life. As a joke, I inserted a passage in my lesson manuscript that read somewhat along the following lines. Quote, have a class member read Acts 20:7-12, and then ask the question, have you ever killed anyone with a sacrament meeting speech? How did it make you feel? What steps can you take in the future to ensure that it does not happen again? So members of the committee laughed, and the committee chairman sent my lesson on up, incorporating their suggested revisions, but also including my little joke to Salt Lake City, where it passed correlation. When I received the galleys of the lesson back for final approval just before it went to press, the joke was still there. I faced one of the greatest moral crises of my life. But finally, I called church headquarters and suggested that they probably didn't really want a lesson to go out to church members entirely as it stood, so the joke was removed.
Oh, that's great.
I think that illustrates something. One, people don't pay attention to a lot of things that are said. I wrote a letter recently to a friend of mine who's a member of the Quorum of the Twelve, and I said, I talked about this problem of, you know, going over and over and over the same, you know, it used to be, originally in correlation, the four scriptural sequence were taught over 8 years. So you could have 2 years of the New Testament, 2 years of but then they truncated that into 4 years, and that meant essentially that we had the same proof texting every year. But anyway, I wrote to him and said that I thought that it was time for the church to create an adult Sunday school class for people who had been through, I mean, your membership into the adult Sunday school class may be certification that you've been through three cycles of the correlated lessons, and then you could move on. But I said that I thought it was a problem, and that there is probably a direct relationship between the number of times we correlate and the size of the gospel doctrine discussion class in the foyer, which grows and grows.
Did you get an answer?
Pardon? No, I didn't. But I often don't.
Chris?
Oh, I get to go second. This is great. Well, I guess gospel doctrine teachers do stand up, but how many people here currently attend gospel doctrine, say, once a month or every other month?
Or month. Or more.
Or more.
Okay. Or more. And how many people have been gospel doctrine teachers? So what I wanted to talk about is I have kind of my best and worst. Like, there's always, and I think every calling has this, the absolute low point. And every calling probably also has a high point, too. Like, in one of my current callings, I haven't found that yet, but the gospel doctrine low point for me was reading through the manual, and there's yet another quote from the doctrinal New Testament commentary. And I had been reading some other commentaries at the same time, and, you know, I was trying to stick to more or less faithful commentaries, where I defined faithful as believe that Jesus Christ existed. It's kind of my baseline of faithful. And the commentators going through, well, there was this, you know, there was this argument, and there was this argument for how we understood something in one of the Gospels. And, oh, by the way, there used to be this really old, now completely debunked theory. And that happens to be what was in you know, this very old from like the 1940s commentary. And you see that almost word for word in Doctrinal New Testament Commentary, which I do not own, but then quoted in the manual. And the reason this is a low point for me is I had, in the same way as Bob, like, you know, follow the manual. And I am going to be somewhat of a Sunstone heretic as well as a borderline Mormon true believer heretic by saying, I think that following the manual can sometimes be a good thing, because as anyone who's sat through a Cleon Skousen, who sat through like the Cleon Skousen version of the manual, and no offense to our brother Skousen, but you know, the first 1,000 years is, you know, that's a tough Sunday school class to sit through. And in fact, I asked someone to sub, and she brought in a lot of that as kind of backup material, and I was requested not to ask her to sub again. So, you know, I think there's probably some benefit in following the manual. Nonetheless, the reason is, well, you know, you kind of don't want to go too far off the reservation. You want to stay with these texts that are inspired. And so to find that particular thing in the lesson manual, I mean, not that I didn't expect it, but just to see it right there staring in my face. So that's my low point. And then the high point is people come up with amazing stories, but it's hard to get them out of there. And they don't, because people don't read. Like, who reads a lesson before they go? All you Gospel Doctrine attendees, who are the readers?
All of your Gospel Doctrine teachers.
Yeah, great. So a few people, and that's the similar percentage. So people don't read, but they do have great experiences. So the trick is to ask the right questions to get these experiences. So just one quick thing, and then I'll tell the other questions that I hope we get to Q&A. We were talking about miracles from the New Testament. I was lucky enough to be the Gospel Doctrine teacher during the New Testament year. I think being the Gospel Doctrine teacher for me during, say, Doctrine and Covenants year would be a different kind of a question when asked to do it. And then we'd have a different kind of confession to make about from the Gospel Doctrine teacher. But I was really afraid that people would come up with them. You know, that when we're talking about miracles, that everyone would just kind of nod their head and go on. And I thought, there's such a richness there. And so I had prepared all these, but what do you think is really happening there kinds of questions. And, well, what about this? And what about these little kids who didn't get better? And the then bishop's wife, who's in the back row, I didn't have to use all those, you know, all this stuff and printouts from the enzyme. It's like, well, we had this example, this happened to us, and we have this son who has really severe autism. And we knew we had enough faith. And we prayed and prayed and prayed that this kid was going to get better. And we went to get the priesthood blessing, and we had already had one that didn't really work, but I was sure this time that it was going to work. And everyone in the ward knows that Jeffy is still very autistic, and his way of interacting with the world is not like yours and mine. And so she's explaining this story about how, and you know what, it didn't work that time either. I thought, that's exactly what I wanted to get across. And then that opened up the way for people to have a real discussion about what that meant for them. And I thought, okay, I think that's what the manual writers want to have happen, but in a stultifying way they haven't put it in there. So the one thing I'd like to get to in the Q&A, since we have a lot of attendees here, is what's your advice for the curriculum writers? I mean, my advice for the curriculum writers is to probably say goodbye to the things like the Doctrinal New Testament Commentary and either update or get rid of those. But how is it that you bring in those things that you really do want to have happen without going into the... Because I think once you go down certain debates, you have an obligation to be truthful to the audience. And I think that even the Correlation Committee feels that obligation to be honest and truthful with the audience. So you can't... It's hard to come at it like, what's the archaeological evidence for the crucifixion? You have to come at it more from a different way. And what is it that we want people to get out of the class? So with that, it's easy for me to complain because I don't love the manual. But then when I'm saying, oh, if someone asked me to be on the curriculum committee, what would I do? I mean, I think Kim has some answer for that, but that's my question. And the other thing for the Q&A is just some really practical things that what can a gospel doctrine teacher do to make things a little bit more interesting. So if we say that the pet peeve is the lack of secondary source, a good secondary source material, where do you find it? Okay, New Testament, it's out there. Old Testament, it's out there. Is there good secondary source material for the Book of Mormon that someone's found that I haven't? Is there great secondary source material for the Doctrine and Covenants lessons? More, I think, more than the Book of Mormon. But where do you find it? Where do you find those things that aren't kind of faith destroying? So that's my little plug for sometimes the manual ain't so bad. I'll turn it over to Kim.
Actually, I think Sheldon's next.
Oh, Sheldon.
Oh, all right. Okay. I have to second what Bob said about gospel doctrine curricula and courses. His grapes are mine. I would compare what the church has created to a society, a hypothetical society, where education is compulsory, but it does not go beyond high school. And in fact, thereafter, you are required to keep repeating high school until you die.
That's good.
And it's not all that hot a curriculum to begin with.
Is woodshop in there?
What's that?
Woodshop?
Woodshop would be an improvement, I think. Maybe when they're talking about building the ark.
That's an idea.
Yeah. The experience that I had as I was teaching gospel doctrine in Palo Alto has to be understood in the context that I was engaged in a PhD program in Near Eastern Studies. I was taking classes at UC Berkeley. I was taking classes at the Graduate Theological Union. For a time, I was a teacher's assistant teaching interpretation of the Pentateuch to future Lutheran ministers at Pacific Lutheran Theological Seminary. And then there was gospel doctrine. And I started reading the manuals in preparation for my early classes, and I realized about five pages in that if I had to give these lessons as they were being written, as they were being presented, by the end of the month, I was going to be naked on the roof with a deer rifle. It was just unthinkable to me to follow these lessons as they were written, because they were so unbelievably inane. The lack of good secondary literature has already been touched upon. There was also, of course, the pressure that I was aware of from my time at BYU not to use certain kinds of translations and so forth. So I staged a kind of quiet, smiling one-man revolt. I decided that I was going to bring in stuff from what I was studying at school and try to make it as palatable and easy to deal with as possible. I tried not to be too controversial. I tried to do things that were sufficiently different on occasion that I figured that the really conservative people, I could blindside them because they might not have ever heard of this, so they weren't quite sure how to respond to it. And that's fine. You know, that will work for a certain type of person. But I also discovered that going beyond high school is not for everybody. I think it is for most people. And I like to use that metaphor because really it's after you get away from high school and you go off to college, that's where you start to sort of assert yourself as an individual. You're away from the parents, you're away from your family. You got to get to find out who you really are. You kind of reinvent yourself a little bit. And the church, by putting this ceiling on learning, makes it difficult for people in their spiritual lives, or at least it prevents the church from being a vehicle for people exploring their own spirituality and their own spiritual and intellectual lives beyond a certain level. And I think that's stunting. I think it's wrong. And quite honestly, I'm here today to preach revolution. Let 1,000 study groups bloom. What would my advice be to the curriculum committee? Retire. Seriously, I can speak with some experience. One thing that for the last several years I have been developing curriculum for a university that I co-founded back in 1997. And in the course of that experience, I have overseen the development of 3 bachelor's, 3 master's degrees, and I've basically written 1 doctoral program. So I understand curriculum development. I understand what makes it tick, and I understand what makes good curriculum and what makes bad curriculum. So I think that I can say with some assurance that the curriculum for gospel doctrine is a mystery to me, because I'm really not clear what the ultimate objectives are. Good curricula is driven by good learning objectives, and writing good learning objectives is hard. But I don't understand what they're getting at. What are they trying to do other than just keep you in the same place for not just the next 40 or 50 minutes, but year after year after year? I believe that if it were up to me, what I would love to see the curriculum committee or somebody do is develop not just this type of thing that gets recycled every 4 or 8 years, but a series of shorter courses that focus on more discrete topics and have a whole bunch of them. I mean, like, 50 or 100 of them, that would maybe go for 10 to 12 weeks, and the lesson material is all there, it's easy to get, maybe it would be downloadable or something, so that instead of going through, some people would get together and say, we would love to find out more about early Christianity. So we do a 10, you know, a 12-week course on early Christianity, say up through the 3rd century, just before Augustine. Or, excuse me, let's do a course on the Old Testament prophets, or let's talk about the Nauvoo period, and have these things discrete, meaty, with good materials, and most importantly, let's get the general membership of the church thinking that it's okay for there to be a little ambiguity in the world. The gospel doctrine courses do not tolerate ambiguity well, and some of the leadership does not tolerate ambiguity well. Especially if you're dealing with the Old Testament, you are going to be up to your lower lip in ambiguity, and if somebody stirs it with their little finger, you'll drown if you don't know how to deal with it. So, and I think this is also a symptom of the leadership of the church. They are no longer gospel scholars as they once were. And so when gospel scholars or aspiring gospel scholars begin to arise among us, they become troublesome. And the leadership doesn't quite know how to deal with them. And I would love to see that change, because how we think about our religion and God and the world and our place in it is really, that's where it is. That's where it starts. You pray, you study, you go hand in hand. If you just simply rely on prayer without the intellectual component, you're basically talking to yourself. And I'm hoping that perhaps more people will simply take the initiative themselves and go out in the foyer and have the discussion there or wherever they can find it.
Thanks. I'm not going to stand. Chris borrowed the technique I was going to use, which was to ask how many people were gospel doctrine teachers and attendees. Let me throw out another question. How many of you are conscientious objectors? All right?
So to the military.
No, to the gospel doctrine. Okay. So now, if I were your gospel, or the gospel doctrine teacher in your ward, each of you would have a good relationship with me, and you would feel comfortable in our discussion. And I think my experience with gospel doctrine is different than the other panelists so far. I was teaching gospel doctrine in the late 80s, early 90s, and the manual was very different than it is now. It consisted of, each lesson consisted of half a page with the citation for the scripture chapters to be studied, plus three or four suggested discussion questions. There was no outline. So basically, I had carte blanche to do whatever I wanted for the lesson.
What church was this?
That's how I treat the manuals.
The only true and living church.
The only true and living church in Gilroy. So each week I would read the scriptures, and my practice is to read it out loud because I just get into it more that way, plus I'm an old theater student. And then on Sunday I would do what I thought was best. So there wasn't really an outline to follow. Sometimes we would do different things. For instance, when we were studying Old Testament, I felt ahead of time that just to spend 1 week talking about the Psalms is to do a disservice to the Psalms. So at the beginning of the year, I pass out a sign-up sheet. So each week, somebody from the class would have chosen one of the Psalms. They could read a part of it and share their thoughts about it. So we did that throughout the whole year.
That's a good way to keep with the curriculum plan, but still manage to do that.
Yeah. And I think on another occasion when we were talking about the book of Job, we had, I took a modern translation, and we kind of had a little dramatic presentation of people reading from the modern translation of Job, so people get an idea of what was going on with the structure of Job. But after I was teaching gospel doctrine, then the curriculum changed for Sunday school, where the teenage Sunday school classes were all changed so that their teenage Sunday school manuals were replaced by the gospel doctrine manual, which meant that the people who were teaching those teenagers now were switching from a three-page outlined lesson to the small little thing I described earlier. And I think that was hard for them, because a few years later, the longer gospel doctrine manuals came out. And at that point in time, the lessons were one page long with an outline, suggested approach to the discussion. And then a few years later, the outlines became longer. For instance, I was looking at it last night, and it's, average length of the lesson is 5 to 6 pages. And so, since I'm not teaching gospel doctrine now, I haven't been dealing with this type of problem. I've teach presidents of the church manual and elders quorum. And in those lessons, once again, we just have a reading selection plus three or four suggested discussion questions. So basically, it's up to me to decide how to organize that discussion. And from my point of view, I am a discussion leader. I'm a facilitator. I'm not a teacher. Now, when I think about teaching, I think about it in terms of continuum. On one end of the continuum is myself as the person in front speaking 100% of the time. The other end of the continuum is a complete open discussion where nobody speaks more than anybody else. Everybody's participating. And, So I'm usually somewhere around, I think when I was teaching Goff's doctrine, it was around about 60 to 70% me talking. Hopefully it was more to 50%. Nowadays, when I'm teaching Elders Quorum, it's more like 50-50 or 60-40 me talking 40% of the time. I prefer to have discussion. And I guess if I was to have a confession here, since nobody's really... I guess we've had implicit confessions. My confession would be, sometimes I find it easier to remember the names of the people in the scriptures than the names of the people in the class. And which leads me to my thought that
That's funny because I find it easier to remember the people in the class.
Ah, well, you see, there's the balance. There's the balance there. I think an effective
exactly.
teacher.
We should co-teach.
Effective. Do the 24-month-olds, right? We'll study Job with the babies. I think an effective teacher has to have both a knowledge of the text and a knowledge of the people in the room. And not just a knowledge, I think a love. I think a love of the text, a love for the people, the brothers and sisters, the people in the room, and also a love of the process of teaching. Let me share a couple of experiences associated with the actual questions here. Best experiences. Two come to mind. One was when we were talking about Doctrine and Covenants. The other is when the cell phone rings. No. We were talking about the Doctrine and Covenants, and so one week...
I have it in my calculator.
One week, I had to discuss Doctrine and Covenants, section 132, dealing with plural marriage. The following week, we were talking about Official Declaration 1, which was the end of plural marriage. And then we're talking about Official Declaration 2, which was the priesthood revelation being extended to all races. So that was it was an interesting 3 weeks. And, so I did a lot of preparation for that. And shared my insights. We talked about post-manifesto polygamy in the second class. And, I shared my thoughts on it, which was, I'm not going to find fault with the people who were in that situation because if you think about polygamy or practice of plural marriage as compared to as what they talk about in driver's ed, where you have a car starting and stopping, you put your foot on the accelerator, it takes a certain amount of time to get up to speed. You put your foot on the gas, it takes a certain amount of time to come to a stop. Plural marriage took a certain amount of time to accelerate to a constant speed. Then when the manifesto happened, it was putting on the brakes, it took a certain amount of time for it to stop. And so, shared that with them, and then in the next section talking about the priesthood revelation, I shared my experiences with them about, just how by accident I happened to be in the Salt Lake Temple in June 1978 when the first black brother was receiving his endowments. I just happened to be in the very same session with that man. And then also shared with them some of the quotation from Brother McConkie about, forget about all those comments that were made explaining the priesthood revelation in the past. That passage was new to many of the people in my class. And also shared with them, some video testimony to some of the African saints who had joined the church. So I thought, we had interesting discussion. And the way I preluded each of those discussions was with a quote from the book of Job, the Lord giveth, the Lord taketh away, blessed be the name of the Lord. And so, in each of those things, something was given and taken away, or something was taken away and then given back. I think the other experience I remember is one time, it's just a portion of a lesson, and I asked somebody to read the scripture, and one of the members of my class who was mentally retarded raised his hand. So I let him read the scripture, and he frequently would, raise his hand to read the scriptural selections, and he stumbles over the words. So I would be helping him read some of the hard words. And I remember some visitors who were there who looked very surprised at that type of situation happening. But in our class, it was just completely normal Sunday morning. Now, if I was to have a dream class for gospel doctrine, the dream class, of course, would be made up of everybody who's in my demographic with my education, and we would be able to go for 2 hours long and spend several weeks talking about one book of scripture. Sort of like when I was taking a class at the Jewish Community Center in Berkeley, we spent about 10 weeks on the book of Job. It'd be nice to spend a long amount of time on these class on this text. But in retrospect, I think that as a teacher, I benefit from having people from diverse backgrounds in the class. It makes me a better teacher because I can't take for granted everybody's everybody knows what I know. Especially because I know there are people coming in, people who have just been baptized, who don't know what we're talking about. And so if we can share, if I can help them understand some things better, great. And if we can share experience, some of our joint experience, and try to implement the principles of becoming like Jesus, that's great. If I have certain things from my experience that help, then I'm happy to share that with them. For instance, I can't teach King Benjamin's speech talking about, you know, what happens if you see a beggar without thinking about finding my former roommate from the singles ward as a homeless person on the streets of Palo Alto years later. So that you know, it's that has an impact on me. And so I have to grapple with that. And I can share the benefit of that with my brothers and sisters in the class. And I'll conclude my comments now. Thanks.
I will stand up. Contrary to my usual form, I actually prepared the whole slide presentation. If I'd known I was going to do that, we'd have a slide projector here. So my name's Kim McCall. And Frank alluded to, I don't know if you read in the program, we were given a set of questions partially to stimulate our thinking, and I will address some of those. First, I want to talk for a second about what I bring to the party, that as a gospel doctrine teacher, like Frank said, I actually love the scriptures. I love to read them. I feel like I learn a lot from them, and I'm occasionally thrilled when I read them. I have a fairly decent knowledge of the scriptures, especially the New Testament. I've read a lot of commentaries over the years and things like that. But I wanted to show you this one slide of an expertise curve. Okay, you line up all the people in the world according to how much they know about something. Okay, and there's this curve that it's very, 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 very flat for a very long time, and then it goes up, and then it goes really, 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 really steep. There's almost, and so almost nobody knows anything about anything. and then if we're talking about the scriptures, you get up to this point and you find me, you know, and I have almost everybody in the world I can teach a lot to, because I know five times as much as anybody else, except to the people to this end of me. And you go up to here and you find Sheldon. And then you go up to here and you find Raymond Brown, who actually knows something. But the important thing about that is that it really is the fact that I understand that while everybody in the class thinks that I know a lot, I know a really, really small portion of what it's possible to know. And I'm aware of that. Like several people have mentioned, I respect ambiguity and uncertainty. I read that to someone who said, respect, try, value, treasure, embrace, and live. Okay. I actually believe in personal revelation. I live to contribute, okay, to the discussion, that is, to help mold our collective experience and understanding. I don't think it's given there. I don't want to just sit and listen to it. I have a terrible problem with the temple that I just am supposed to sit and listen, and I make a really bad sheep. But as long as I can contribute, as long as I can help mold our understanding, I'm really happy. It seems that I ask thought-provoking questions. Tiny stories. I got to teach the seniors in high school the summer before college. And I walked in and I started teaching whatever the lesson was about. And the kids are like staring at me whenever I ask them questions. And these are not idiots. One of the kids in the class spent the next 4 years at Princeton. And they're staring at me like they don't understand it. What's going on? Are you guys like not, am I asking too hard of questions? And one of the kids said, you don't understand, Kim, for our entire lives in the church, the answer to every question that we were ever asked was Heavenly Father, Jesus Christ, or pray about it. and you are asking real questions, and we're not quite sure what to do here. And I said, your lives are about to change. So anyway, and my nieces and nephews would tell you I always have to be teaching somebody something. I am famous wherever I attend church for teaching from the back row. And here's a quote from somebody that's actually real important to the way that I teach. Even if you're not sure that Amulek was a real person, you talk about him like he was your brother or your good friend. scriptures matter to me, and they're alive to me. Great experiences. I taught a lesson on the book of Job that, you know, I didn't get 10 weeks, but I really, really studied the book of Job. And I found in there an amazing account of what it is to struggle with ambiguity, to struggle with your knowledge of God, to struggle with how the world is, and to come to know God better through that struggle. And I taught it that way, and people for weeks were telling me what a great lesson it was. I ended up giving a Sunstone paper on it that talks about the big questions of life.
That was outstanding, by the way.
Thanks, Sheldon. It was, actually. I mean, I haven't done that much that's that great in my life. And the paper on Job, we actually have a video of it. I can make a CD. I also taught the creation. I've taught in various wards, and there was a singles ward in my area, and I didn't want to attend the singles. I didn't want to join the singles ward because I love being in my ward. But I went over there one week, and some guy was teaching gospel doctrine. Some very new convert was teaching gospel doctrine by reading questions out of the manual. And I said, "This ward is going to die." And I went to the Sunday school president, and I said, "I remember this thing in the DNC that says if you have desires to serve, you are called to the work, and you want me to teach gospel doctrine in this ward, and I'm not going to join the ward." And they let me teach for like 5 years in this ward without joining the ward. And we were beginning the Old Testament, and we're teaching creation, and this woman said, "Okay, I really want to know what Kim McCall actually believes about creation." Okay, and I was able. So it was a very interesting time. What do you really think? And it helped that I had really thought about how to think about the story of creation. What do I think the Garden of Eden is teaching us, or how should I treat it, and all that sort of stuff. It was a great experience. Which leads into the next question, answering hard questions. This will be a tiny bit obvious, but you should admit that there are hard questions. And as some of us learned last night, we can sing a song, line upon line. Anyway, that we don't have to understand everything right now, and that there are hard questions. Sorry to be a tiny bit preachy, but I actually believe that the example of your faithfulness may matter more than the depth of your insight. That if people can see that you've struggled with it and that you're faithful, if you don't have a great answer, that doesn't matter as much. Be as honest. Pardon?
What do you mean by faithful?
So I actually mean, in this case, that you stay involved, that you continue to, the obvious, the superficial manifestation is that you still come to church. But, you know, Job he was very angry at God, but he didn't leave the relationship, okay? And so it gets to that, okay, that I stay involved in asking the question, I stay engaged with the people, I don't drop out in some sense because I find something hard, okay, and I find various things very hard this last year and other times. And people in my ward know that, you know, that I spoke 4 minutes before in sacrament meeting, 4 minutes before the letter was read in June or whenever that was, and talked about it slightly indirectly. But people really, really valued that honesty. And I say, be as honest as you can without sowing more doubts than people can handle. That's obvious. But so I just three examples of hard questions in increasing difficulty for me. What do you believe about the Garden of Eden and about the flood? Do you believe that God really wanted the saints to practice polygamy? Will it exist in heaven? And if the Tower of Babel story is fiction, then what about the Jaredites?
So those are the questions. What are the answers?
I have long answers to the Garden of Eden question. I think actually Mormons have a lot to say about creation and a lot to say about the Garden of Eden. The simple answer is that it's telling the same story essentially as the Mormon creation myth, which is okay. That's the Jewish creation myth. Okay, the Mormon creation myth is the preexistence. Okay, and it's telling us the same thing about leaving God's presence and being here in a world of strife and da 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 da. Everything except the idea of original sin is. which wasn't there to begin with, according to Sheldon. Thank you. My dream class, first of all, the School of the Prophets. Everybody comes prepared. Everybody comes seeking and expecting revelation. There's a spirit of discovery rather than recitation or regurgitation. The greatest class I've ever attended that I didn't teach, no, sorry, that was a joke, was actually Sheldon teaching the first 14 verses of John, okay? In the beginning was the Word, and so forth. Denise was in the class who speaks Greek, knows it inside and out. The greatest one-hour tour through the Word in both senses that I've ever had.
It was also the course. It was also the class that got me fired.
but we learned more in that. I experienced the scriptures in a more enlightening way than I almost ever experienced them. I lacked only Todd Compton for my joy to be full. Okay. Anyway, enough on that. Dream curriculum: a year on the Gospels, taught serially rather than in parallel. 9 months on the Atonement, separate idea. Mark, Luke, Matthew, John, Paul, Amulek, Joseph Smith, one month of compare, contrast, and synthesize of the class, and then 1 month of individual essays by class members. There once was a class called the 70s Course on Theology, where for 4 years, I think B.H. Roberts wrote 4 years worth of lessons on how to think about God. That would be worth studying.
It's pretty amazing.
It's really amazing. You've already seen the master of maxims and aphorisms in action here, but I have several little aphorisms that I don't think of myself as an aphoristic thinker, but apparently in my old age I started crystallizing a few things. Anyway, not every scriptural discussion has to be a Rorschach test about what does this mean in your life. Okay, it's occasionally okay to impart actual factual knowledge. These get better, I said under there. Okay, not every.
And more people attend the class when you're in the habit of doing that. More people actually go to the class when there are specific gospel doctrine classes, you know, because in my ward they rotate the teachers a lot. When the teacher isn't scared of imparting factual knowledge, more people attend. It's a very obvious correlation.
In the singles ward that I taught, I mean, the bishopric, their big brag to the stake president was, we don't have a four-year gospel doctrine class. Okay, everybody goes to Sunday school. Everybody goes to class because there was stuff to learn, and it was exciting discussions. It really was. And it wasn't a bunch of geniuses, but it was a bunch of people who were willing to learn and eager to hear and eager to talk. Not every discussion has to be geared to the least common denominator, to the weakest of saints. Learning is really fun, at least for a lot of us. Okay. Did you say that? You didn't say this. Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John all understood Jesus differently.
Okay. We were just talking about that before.
Yeah. Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John all understood Jesus differently, and so can you. Okay. Paul experienced the atonement. Paul experienced the atonement. His efforts to explain it were conditioned by his intellectual and cultural framework, by his vocabulary. God has yet to reveal many great and important things. Okay. I have a little Boy Scout one here. Be prepared. I'm gonna manifest my arrogance here. I gave one really good lesson in that ward that, and somebody came up to, I mean, it was really a good lesson, and drew on a whole lot of stuff. And a guy came up to me afterwards and said, how long did it take you to prepare that lesson? And I said, forgive me, but, you know, 42 years. So there are people here who have been paying attention in class for 50 years, okay, or 71 years or whatever it's been. And we have a lot to share, and we can bring that in. Okay, have fun. It's a gospel of joy. Celebrate God's word. Don't be afraid to rejoice, or you're going to be cute. It's easier if you're Chris Corbett, but we do what we can. The manual is a crutch to help you prepare a passable lesson when you don't have time to prepare a good one. It can be more than that. I think you're okay. So, okay. Prophets, with the possible exception of Isaiah, were people. Still are. These vary between the sublime and the ridiculous. The gospel of Christ embraces all truth. wherever it's found. I don't mean the way we teach it, it has all truth. I mean wherever it is, the true gospel of Christ welcomes it. A hard one for me. They have something to contribute to. And they'll get more out of the lesson when they discover and express ideas themselves. Along with Sheldon, here we go. Certainty is a harlot of great price and little value.
Why the harlot part?
Because it's seductive.
Oh.
Because it wants you to pay for it, and it pays you pay a great deal in integrity. Sorry, you pay a great deal in integrity for certainty. I actually meant it seriously. It's a harlot. It seduces you into a sense of something that is not genuine, and you pay a lot for it.
Chris's question is, can you make it less sexist?
Oh, was it?
No, it was really more just a kind of reaction harlot. That I think was driven partly by that, but just also trying to understand it.
He was speaking inclusively of harlots of all genders.
All harlots of all genders. It really was about seduction and paying for something that doesn't have any truth or value to it.
And that has lost your point completely.
Okay.
My father uses the term manslut.
I thought of slut, and I thought I should use a scriptural term.
A slut.
Okay.
Does the NIV use slut?
Does the NIV use slut? I think they use prostitute, actually, in the NIV. Knowing God is of infinitely greater worth than knowing about God. One of the two big lessons of Job. Knowing God does not come cheaply. See Job, Moses, and Joseph Smith. And finally, revealing even glimpses of the glory... I don't need to do this. Okay. Revealing even glimpses of the glory, the beauty, the profundity of the gospel can inspire faithfulness, can encourage communion, can enliven the soul, and lead us toward God. Applaud for all five of us, please. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. We've got about a half hour left for questions and discussion, and I'd like to start off by, are there any panel members who have a brief, addendum or comment on something someone else has said? Go ahead.
Well, I think that, the question arises, obviously everyone here loves teaching gospel doctrine. It's the best calling in the church in a way. And I think I finally surrendered to the idea that a few people come to learn and most people come to be reassured. And that a lot of what we do is to reassure. And if we don't do that, we tend to get fired. Because people get very unsettled if things don't... it's okay to raise some ambiguity or raise some anxiety as long as you resolve it by the end of the period. If you leave anxiety hanging, as I sometimes am wont to do, people get kind of uncomfortable. I had the experience in the Westwood Second Ward a number of years ago at the height of the civil rights movement, to be teaching a class on blacks in the priesthood, and we had a visitor from someplace in the South who felt he was in the wrong church and stood up and said something very challenging about that I shouldn't be teaching gospel doctrine in this class. Pardon? He always stood up in class because anything having to do with blacks, I guess, was... whatever. So I said, look, your quarrel's not with me, it's with the bishop, because he's called me to this. And he said, well, where's the bishop's office? And I said, it's down there. And he walked down and went in to see the bishop, who happened to be Bert Skoll, who is a Jewish convert. And I think he was sure that he was in the wrong church. I had another experience with a bishop, Royal Peterson, that I was his first counselor to. And when he and I had been teaching gospel doctrine class, and so I said, why don't we just keep doing that? And he said, you mean as members of the bishop? I said, sure. What a great opportunity for people in the ward to have a bishop teaching gospel doctrine class. And he liked that idea, and so we did that. And then at our board conference when the state president came, he challenged that and said to the bishop, I'm not so sure this is a good idea. You know, Bishop Peterson, that a preaching bishop is a curse. And Bishop Peterson, without dropping a note, said, yes, President, but a teaching bishop is a blessing. That time that we spend in that 40, 50 minutes, whatever it is, I think is in some ways the best opportunity in the 3-hour block to do something significant. And I think that the teacher who is passionate about that, who loves the scriptures, who loves the Lord, who loves teaching, is likely, even if nothing happens, to have a good experience in doing that. But occasionally, something happens that makes you think that it's all worthwhile, where somebody awakens, or they awaken you. And something, the whole reason we come, I remember going to hear Dave Brubeck play a jazz concert at the University of Utah. And before he and his quintet started to play, he came out and said, you've come with certain expectations. And as musicians, you've come with certain expectations of us. As musicians, we've come with certain expectations of you. We hope it happens tonight. And I think that's what we do in Gospel Doctrine Class. We hope that what we have come to do happens. And sometimes it does, and when it does, it's wonderful.
Yeah, I wanted to ask a question to the other panel members. Do you find that your particular approach to teaching, or your style of teaching, is affected by the discipline that you're in? For instance, I know it was mine that I tend towards more of a narrative approach, and so because my studies were in theater and film, but I just wanted to ask the other people on the panel that.
Yes.
So my undergraduate degree was in philosophy, and my graduate degree is in computer science. So it's hard to answer.
Yeah.
It's hard to know.
Ambiguous.
Yeah, mine's certainly informed by my 40 or so years of teaching literature and the arts. It's also informed by a lot of other stuff I read. I'm a very eclectic reader, and so I read in a lot of different subjects, and whenever something seems to fit, or even if it may not, and I think it's important, I try to bring it in. And but also, I think, you know, there has to be, to some extent, a trusting of the process of discourse and of dialogue and of inviting. You know, lots of times, people, you know, they tend to pass out scripture for people to read. And then read them, and everybody knows what it says. And so there's an automatic kind of process within our teaching, in priesthood or whatever it is. I can almost always give the answer before somebody else gives it, because I know that it's heard, and that's the answer that's given. Occasionally, somebody gives a different answer, just like when occasionally somebody prays and they speak to God as you. And everybody listens. And so when someone gives something which is not the expected answer, not the routinized kind of response, it's nice. So as teachers, I think part of our responsibility is to give and to evoke something different, something a little bit out of the ordinary.
For me, I kind of had an ideal that I was exposed to when I was at Berkeley, that I kind of aspired to, even though I knew it wasn't possible in gospel doctrine classes. I had the privilege of taking advanced readings in biblical Hebrew taught by Jacob Milgram, who was not only one of the top scholars in Old Testament law, ritual, and purity, but he was also an ordained rabbi. And he taught me the value of slowing down in going through a text. We would spend an entire semester, about 15 weeks, on a single chapter of Leviticus. And we would usually go through about one verse in 1 2.5-hour session. And you think to yourself, how is that even possible? And in fact, there were times, I wasn't there for this particular one, when there was one preposition that was a little ambiguous, and they spent like 2.5 sessions on a single letter of the text trying to figure out what is going on here, and they eventually came to a conclusion. You can't obviously do that in gospel doctrine, but I liked to try and slow down a bit and really drill into the scripture, because one thing I've discovered is they're tough. They can take it. You can handle them a little roughly if you need to. They are what they are, and they will teach you what they will teach you if you are willing to let them speak for themselves.
I think you can do that in gospel doctrine, but you just can't expect to cover the entire reading selection in 40 minutes.
Yeah, you pick and choose. Yeah. You pick the one.
It's okay, there will be another turn in 4 years where they can get the
other. They'll get it.
Yes.
I developed some sympathy for the curriculum committee when we lived in Russia.
Mm-hmm. See?
These people have not had any religion for 40 years. Mm-hmm. How on earth do you create a curriculum for those people and the rest of us?
So I like Bob's suggestion.
Could you repeat the question just briefly?
Oh, the question was, Sharon and Bob lived in Russia for a while as missionaries, where people have not had religious instruction for 40 years. And it was very, very useful to have manuals written at the level that the church manuals are written. And how do you create a curriculum that works for those people and works for us in this room? And Bob had a suggestion, which is, you know, you don't. you have people in classes that are appropriate for their level of understanding.
Go ahead and write that curriculum. Just don't inflict it on the rest of us.
Yeah.
There already is gospel essentials and gospel doctrine. You could have gospel essentials, bust gospel doctrine as it currently exists to gospel principles.
But gospel essentials does not teach the scriptures.
No.
Yeah.
Neither does gospel doctrine.
Well, I think that the I do think that there is something to be said for additional curriculum. Whether it's, I like Sheldon's idea a lot. I think that if you're faithful and you go to church and you go to Sunday school, you're using the same text year after year after year after year. I've been through that cycle recently, about 8 years, and while I take seriously teaching and I spend a lot of time on the lesson and I try to do something which is different and something which is evocative and bring in. None of my classes are the same. Still, it's difficult. It's challenging. And most, there is a sense for some people. And I with Chris, I value the lesson manual. I value it as a set place to consider and to often as a point of departure. But if it becomes a Procrustean bet, then what is happening is that people are mumbling the answers and going through the process, but not really learning. I mean, it isn't a school in the same way that the school of the prophets is, or same way that we think of school, where there's enlightened and engaged learning. For many people, it's not that. And I accept the fact that many people come simply to be reassured. They're not interested in learning anymore. They know more than they care to, and they're not living up to what they know. But there's a group of people who really have a hunger and a thirst for understanding the scriptures and for understanding the doctrine, and for whom the routinized, stereotyped answers are not sufficient. And Milton says, he talks about the shepherd, if the sheep wander to a higher level than the shepherd will lose the sheep. The shepherd must be at the same level, at least, where the sheep are. And I think that a gospel doctrine teacher is a shepherd. So keep that in mind with all of the associations that has with who the Savior is. And he is the great teacher. And keep in mind that he often taught in very provocative, very challenging ways. He wanted people to think. The parables are anything but pat answers to serious questions. So it's for those people that really want to learn that I see my greatest responsibility as a teacher.
Let me say something here. I think when we're talking about the scriptures, the Word of God, that is the fresh fruit that fresh fruit and produce that we've been given. The manual is a cookbook with suggested recipes for each week. We as teachers are the cooks. We can decide whether we're going to use that recipe or do something a lot better, depending upon the people who are going to be at our table and what we know that they can eat, what they're used to eating. We are the ones who are going to serve it. But the manuals, I don't think the manual is supposed to be a straitjacket.
Tom.
You talk about you're there to reassure people. I think that the vast, well, my experience in the Mormon book trade is that the best way to hide stuff from Mormons is to publish it. Mormons are not coming to Sunday school to be educated. They're coming to be, as you say, reassured. I say they're coming to get their spiritual recharge. And I find that the lessons I hear that have an uplifting message has a broader effect upon my board and my community. They're not there to learn about the scriptures. If they want to learn about the scriptures, they go out and learn about the scriptures. There's plenty of secondary and primary and resources available to them, but they don't. They're not interested.
They don't have permission to go out and learn about the scriptures on their own.
But I think that they are there to get their weekly recharge. I remember when I started teaching Elders Forum, I started having questions about opening more book trade. I had questions, so I said, please, my brother. I'm going to ask my brother. Well, yeah, that was a disaster. I got to sit down in the middle of my lesson and kicked out of the nursery the next week. You know, that's just the way it goes. I think you're struggling, and that's why I'm sitting in the hallway during the class, because the conservative, vocal conservatives have taken over those classes for the most part, at least in Utah. And the rest of us are left to hobble there.
Yeah, I guess I wish I were convinced that people are coming to get a spiritual recharge. I think some of them do, but I think that, you know, our prayers are so formulaic, our teaching is so routinized. I think one of the things, I mean, I think the teachers here try to do things to make that happen. I think one of the most interesting classes I ever taught on the Sabbath day was the week, 2 weeks before I passed out a survey, and I asked everybody, what kinds of things would you do on the Sabbath day? And wow, I think everyone assumed that there were certain things that nobody would do. But it was really interesting to see that the guy who would never go to a movie thought fishing was one of the best things you could do on the Sabbath. But it opened up the sense of, gee, we're not all the same, and how we understand the Sabbath day is very different, and got people really talking about what it meant to keep the Sabbath day and what kinds of things were acceptable to some and not acceptable to others. So I think that part of it is making people, you know, awaken a little bit to the possibilities of what the gospel holds.
And I find, at least when it happens, that kind of awakening is a spiritual recharge. That to be engaged and feel like the gospel is interesting is takes you through your week, as well as, you know, nice stories about something.
Yeah. I think this survey idea is good. I mean, we did a little, like, survey, just pick your favorite beatitude. And everyone was very interested in what everyone else's favorite beatitude is, and it wasn't the same one for both. And it was a little bit self-revelatory for the people who did it. I think on that same way, when you're trying to talk about, you know, I find this class so stultifying. When I was called, the bishop was like, look, I'm just tired of Sunday school being totally stultifying. So I had a little bit of permission to be that way. But you can ask it as a survey-type question, even if you're doing the back row thing. And I know Jonna knows that this is successful. Like, well, how many other people think that blah, 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 blah? And then, sure, everyone assumed everyone thought the same, but it's not the case. So I think my personal challenge to myself is to make Sunday school, even if I'm not the teacher, when I go, to say, to have you go home with a new thought in your head or a new question, or a new spiritual recharge. You know, anything that's a little bit new of what you're going to do, and there are ways you can do that even as a class member. I think that's a bigger challenge, but you can do it.
Seems you struggle with that in gospel doctrine, for example, the elders' quorum, they pull the old man away and they let us young guys sit and talk to each other and become friends. But as soon as you bring the old guys in, the whole thing shifts more conservative. And then when you bring the women in on top of that, the thing goes even more conservative.
Interesting, because in my world it's the other way. The women will have a nice lesson about how on motherhood, which means let's all nurture each other and talk about specific ways that nurturing can be of value in our communities. And the men will have had that same lesson that same day and talk about how their wives should stay home and not work.
Are those the elders' wives or the high priest's
elders' wives?
Okay.
Following on your comment about learning new things, I formalized that in the class I taught many, many years ago. We called it the Marek Hoffer. And at the end of the class, anybody who wanted to could say what they found in the class that was new or an old idea that had changed for them because of the class. And I was often astonished at two things. One, how thoughtful they actually were when they hadn't said a thing, or how they totally missed what I thought I was teaching. But it was a good technique to kind of find out where you were and where the class was.
I wanted to just mention something in response to something Chris said. When I was teaching Book of Mormon one year, the utter absence of useful commentary was a real cramp in my style. And I got a hold of Farms publishes a series of four semesters worth of Hugh Nibley's lecture notes on the Book of Mormon. And Hugh Nibley's real uneven, in my opinion, about how reliable he is, but he's very fascinating on social questions. And he reads the Book of Mormon. A whole lot of his reading of the Book of Mormon is in terms of, as a socialist. He reads it as a socialist. And
you could argue the book is one long socialist diatribe against any sort of social stratification, education. It came to represent all the things I detest. But go on.
Exactly. Okay. So, Hugh Nibley wants to reassure people about a lot of things that are maybe not legitimate to reassure people about, but he's also reading it socially. And I found this really helpful in bringing out a level of the text that hardly ever gets mentioned and that really, really is there.
I had the same experience.
And so I actually recommend, not everything, there's totally bogus stuff in that book that even I know is bogus. But there's some fabulous stuff too. Jonna?
I just wanted to pitch for Grant Gardner's Book of Mormon commentary. I don't agree with everything in it, but it's fun because he notices things that I necessarily, and he has observations about them. It just kind of, it's another way. That's what I love about commentary. You can open the text even if you don't agree with it.
Brant Gardner. Brant.
When was this written?
Greg Crawford Books published in about 3 years.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So another
Gardner.
It's still online. It was online too, which was
I have a question. How has the internet changed your teaching?
So I have an answer to that that ties back to John's thing. We're trying to find what are the secondary sources. I have found one way to kind of help open the text is to just use the Ensign articles, and you'll find that they don't all say the same thing because Peter, James, and John didn't say the same thing. And you go and you say, okay, well, here's this topic that we're supposed to discuss in the text, and it's been talked about this by this general authority in 1985 like this, and this general authority in 1989 like this, and I find myself a little more sympathetic to view one, but what do you think, class? And so,
there's a book like that. Do you remember the Miners?
Oh, yes. It's just statements of the general of the first presidency or something like that.
Over the years,
yeah, very interesting to pick a subject and see how the official line has changed over the years. Tom would be happy to set you up with a copy of that book. It's really fascinating.
What's the name of it? Statements of the LDS First Presidency.
Question from Douglas.
The question was asked, how has the internet changed your teaching? And I'm one of the contributors to the Feast Upon the Word blog, if you guys are familiar with that. And you know, when
I go
we
there.
and I'm one of the I'm the worst contributor there for sure. But having this outlet on the internet where people of similar and sometimes dissimilar backgrounds and interests can get together, and specifically there for the sake of teaching and strengthening your lessons, it's sort of like being in this room here, but you can get there any day of the week.
I personally found the internet a wonderful resource because there's so many possibilities, both in LDS and others, to take advantage of.
I think I actually wrote an article in Sunstone about the internet back when it was just barely getting started, and some of the things that I predicted happened and some of them didn't, but one thing that I did see pretty clearly was that there were going to be different homes for different colors and flavors of belief, and that has certainly happened. And I think this is a very, very, very good thing, because one of my biggest complaints about the whole idea of correlation is that it is essentially an attempt to homogenize the belief of everybody. And I will go so far as to say that that's borderline evil. Seriously, because we don't all think alike. If we do, most of us are redundant. We don't benefit from it. It doesn't give us a chance to grow and do the kinds of personally self-driven self-development that we're supposed to be here doing on this. Which is a very Mormon idea. So, to the extent that this gives room for other people to explore things in their own way, in their own time, make their own mistakes and hopefully correct them, great. You know, the internet may be the one thing that really kind of rescues the Mormon community. The role that the institutional church is going to play in what results, I think, remains to be seen.
It can also be a trap, however, because there are certain websites that simply make it easy for you to teach a lesson.
Right.
And just go, and it's all there, and all the quotes and everything. So I worry a little bit about it being a crutch, but I think it's like any instrument, any technology, it can be.
That's when you have to go away from the lecture end of the continuum.
Yeah.
And go towards having the people involved in the discussions and throwing out the questions to which they don't already know an answer, and hearing what they have to say and hearing their experiences.
You know, a good way to do this might be to assign people in your class to follow certain blogs or whatever, and then bring that material to class. This is what we did in Milgram's class, was that he would have us each following different commentaries or different versions of scripture. So I had I had to follow two commentaries and a medieval commentator, and the guy next to me was following the Septuagint and something else, and the person across from me was following whatever. And then as the things came up in class, we would each kind of pipe up and say, okay, well, here's what this guy has to say about this. And it actually was a lot of fun and gave us a chance to really explore things in depth.
And there's some tools. There's something called BibleGate. You can go in and you can put a scripture in, and you can go to maybe 20 different translations of it. So it's really kind of fun to be able to just type it in, and then you go down and see some of the nuances in terms of the interpretation.
Bill had a question.
Yeah, I had a question concerning a teaching technique that our gospel doctrine teacher had, and that is, at the very beginning, he reads something that's very scintillating, citing current news unrelated to the lesson, but just basically to get the attention of, you know, the students. And I asked a professor when we were visiting our daughter back in North Carolina, who teaches at the University of North Carolina, said, was that a teaching a good teaching technique? Is it, you mean in some other way? I'm just wondering if you've done that and thought about that.
I do that.
People don't come at the beginning of class, so I think one of the challenges is that you know it's hard to do an end-to-end lesson. You have to find ways that you have many multiple entry points, just because that's what your audience is.
Government bails out AIG to the tune of $300 billion.
discuss
what Leviticus says about it.
You could do that with the Book of Mormon.
So I used to, I mean, it's an attention-grabbing thing. I used to find some song, it may be a hymn or it may be a popular song, and I'd write it out the first couple measures of it on the board, but it applied to the lesson, and they had to figure out what the song was and figure out how it applied to the lesson.
Questions, gospel answers.
Yeah. Every answer is the beginning of the next question.
Okay. Well, before we end, I have a confession. As an outsider who, never been a member of the LDS Church, but visited quite a bit, my experience in gospel doctrine classes has been mostly very positive. I've had many very spiritual, synchronistic experiences. Now, I've been lucky enough, and I'm able to pick and choose, first of all.
You've been to Bob's class, yes.
I'm visiting, made a point to go to Phil McLemore's classes when I've been in Utah, and John Kessler's. But for myself, if I just find out what the lesson is on and take a little time to go into it, now, I love secondary sources, and I'm going into that, I usually find a way in that's very enriching for myself. And I also find, from going to other churches as well, I also find just having a regular process of going through the scriptures, even if it's too fast, even if it's many times superficial, is a really good process. I mean, that's one thing that I really value about Mormonism, is having that regular process. So that's my little confession.
Cool. Come down to Gilbert sometime.
Cool. Anybody else? We are just about to the end. Maybe
3 minutes. More comment. Question, Lisa.
Maybe you've already answered this. There are no secondary sources to the Book of Mormon. But I was having a discussion with somebody at work, and he said, "Well, aren't there all these commentaries?" And I guess there are, but I don't know. I guess we mentioned one that was good.
Jonna and I mentioned the
line, and then you define.
Can I ask a question then? Why do we need secondary sources?
Oh, same reason we need mines, the same reason we need something besides potatoes and meat. Secondary sources can be, you can start relying on them too much, but the reason I need them is that a lot of people have a lot better insights than I do into a lot of scriptures, and so I study the scriptures, but if I, I've just been reading Walter Wink, who's a Christian a scholar who just enlightens me on a lot of things that I know. You grow up in the church, you think you know the scriptures because you've heard those scriptures interpreted
over and over.
Because you memorize
the seminary ones.
That's right. And then somebody comes along, and I was at First Congregational Church in Santa Cruz a couple of weeks ago, last Sunday, at a jazz communion, which was really fun. And the minister there talked about John 3:16. And who doesn't know that one? And yet he said, the Greek says, that Jesus says to Nicodemus, that which is born of flesh is flesh, that which is born from above rather than of spirit. And he said, you can't understand John 3:16 without understanding Jesus' conversation with Nicodemus, which I had never really made those two connections. But then he said, he started talking about how different it makes us see what Jesus is saying in John 3:16, if we really understand what the Greek says, I would have never thought of that or known that. And it really, I thought, wow, this is fun. And I'm going to use that in my one of the sessions that I'm going to take.
My short answer is, their world was not our world. And that's why you need secondary sources.
For the Book of Mormon?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, so if you don't have a secondary source for the Book of Mormon, then how do you handle that situation? Do you just find something on the internet that you can call a secondary source, or do you use your imagination?
There's all kinds of secondary sources on the Book of Mormon. There's a tremendous body of literature on the Book of Mormon.
But I think you can teach a very legitimate class just going through the text, having experience with text.
Of course, absolutely.
I mean,
the purpose of a secondary source is to provide further enlightenment and enrichment, and you can teach the entire Book of Mormon without ever using a single outside source, which I've done. I've also done teaching using some of Nibley and some of the other
Book of Mormon scholars' insight, and that's.
I apologize. I thought I heard someone say that there weren't adequate secondary sources for the Book of Mormon. So
There aren't adequate commentaries, but secondary sources, as a rule, I think commentary is just a subset of that.
So we've come to the end of our allotted time, and I want to thank the panelists and thank you all for coming.
Thank you all. Thank you for your contribution.
Great. Awesome.